This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 348, was produced on November 3rd, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. One River Asset Management founder and CIO Eric Peters returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss why Eric thinks that post-pandemic patterns in everything from inflation to supply chain disruptions yields a conclusion that we've moved from a paradigm of mean reversion to a new paradigm of reflexivity.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Listeners, be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after Eric's feature interview with Eric Peters, where Eric, Nick, and I discuss the reaction to the FOMC hawkishness on the S&P 500, the VIX, and that US dollar move. As well, we'll touch on crude oil, gold, uranium, and the 10-year treasury yield. Now, Eric, before we move on to the feature interview with Eric Peters, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory numbers.
EIA posted a crude oil drawdown of 3.1 million barrels, which was huge against expectations of a build of 267,000 barrels. But boy, if you look at what really happened, it was actually a 5 million barrel drawdown if you adjust for the 1.9 million that was taken out of the SPR, offsetting that draw to yield 3.1 million that was actually reported by EIA. Meanwhile, API this week, that's the private service, not the government service, which reports on Tuesday afternoons, reported a utterly massive 6.5 million barrel drawdown. Very, very bullish indication. Now, a lot of people use API just as a predictor of what EIA is going to do, and they consider EIA to be the official source. They forget about API as soon as the EIA number has been published. I don't see it that way. They collect data in different ways. They have different views of the market. I think they're both important. What we're seeing is really big drawdowns, particularly on the API side, the private inventory side this week. Cushing, Oklahoma, building a desperately needed 1.3 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 1.3 million barrels. Distillates building 865,000 barrels. Diesel inventories are still a big deal, particularly in PADD 1, the U.S. Northeast. We're working on getting a guest on the show to discuss physical market dynamics in energy. We'll have more for you on that next week. U.S. production ticking back down to 11.9 million barrels. That's down 100,000 from last week. Tape action and reaction to inventory was up modestly on that bullish inventory draw, but the upside price action really got going when the Pentagon made a statement saying that they had credible intelligence that Iran would attack Saudi Arabia within 48 hours. The other market-moving event this week was Tuesday morning when rumors came out that China would exit COVID lockdowns by March of 2023. Now, that rumor has subsequently been denied by official sources who say that China remains committed to its zero COVID policy. But when you ignore the headlines and go back to what the guy who started all of this actually said, what he actually said was that he'd heard that a committee had been formed, headed up by a very well-connected individual in the CCP, and that they were figuring out what was going to happen, targeting approximately March. Well, if that's what the real rumor was, it is no surprise that there was an official denial, because obviously they're not ready to announce anything yet. They just pulled a committee together to figure out what the plan is going to be. I do take this news, despite the fact that it's now been officially denied and most market participants are now ignoring it, I do take it as an indication that something is afoot. It's still early. We don't have an official announcement. We don't know when we're going to get an official announcement, but it feels to me like we're moving closer to China finally coming out of its COVID lockdowns. So far, as these various bullish factors have hit the tape, the 200-day moving average, which is holding right now at $90 even, has been the resistance force. So it's a question of when we get over that $90 figure. We were over it briefly in reaction to inventory, and then the Pentagon announcement came back down early on Thursday morning. We're just above the five-day moving average, hovering around $88.50 or so. My call is to look for a decisive break above that 200-day moving average after midterms, if not sooner. Now, if I'm right, this will begin a structural bull market in crude that should last through at least the first quarter. And that's regardless of whether President Biden refills the SPR as promised. Now, if President Biden decides to even further drain the SPR and continue trying to hold gasoline prices down, well, there's only so much left. I don't think we can get at the previous drawdown rate beyond another 6 months or so before we've completely drained it down to nothing. I don't really think it's headed that way. I think more likely as we pass the electioneering efforts that I think have been going on, these extreme shenanigans with the SPR ought to be over. And I think that the September 26th low at $76.25 on WTI will probably prove to be the low, and it's all uphill from here. Now, of course, if they really get crazy and start further draining the SPR or doing other wild things in order to move gasoline prices down, anything is possible in the short term. But we're going to pay for it with higher prices in the long term. There is no getting around the fact that higher prices are coming. The question only is how long we continue to engage in this reckless and irresponsible practice of trying to delay the inevitable at the expense of national security.
This week's feature interview guest is One River Asset Management founder, Eric Peters. Now, Eric, why did we get Eric Peters back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Eric Peters is a very solid macro guy. His firm has an excellent reputation. He was also very early to call the inflation trend, and he's also been writing about growing geopolitical trends recently. These are all topics that are near and dear to my heart and to many of our listeners, so we wanted to get Eric back on for an update.
Well, Eric's interview with Eric Peters is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Eric Peters, founder and chief investment officer for One River Asset Management and One River Digital. Eric, it's great to have you back. It's been way too long. You know, I really enjoy reading your weekend notes email that I get every single Saturday. I particularly was interested in a comment that you made saying that the strongest or best, I think the way you phrased it was the best armed military powers in the world are suddenly at odds with each other or in direct conflict. Tell us a little bit more about how you see this geopolitical situation, what's driving it, and what it means for markets.
Sure. Eric, great to be back. It has been a while, actually. And boy, a lot happened in the world. It feels like we have new things to talk about every time we get together. So what I referenced was it seems apparent that we're in a period of rising conflict and it's becoming more explicit. So this past week, I was referring specifically to the Russians claiming that the UK Ministry of Defense or Defense Ministry had been intervening in the drone attack on the Black Sea fleet. And then I think what really caught my eye as well is that we had the last week we had a Senate report that came out that actually said it was, I don't know the exact terms, but reasonably likely that that COVID came from a lab. And that comes after a couple years of strong statements in opposition to that, that theory. And I think that you know, there are plenty of people who looked at the original COVID leak and had observed that there was at least a reasonable probability or possibility to come from a lab. And, you know, and yet I think probably for political reasons, the government pushed back hard on that. So it's just interesting that all of a sudden it seems to be the opposite is true.
Eric, one of the rules of investing is that wars are almost always inflationary. Right now, we don't actually have a hot war between superpowers. We have a proxy war or a cold war, if you want to call it that. I think it's rapidly escalating in the direction of a hot war, but we're not there yet. Is it time to conclude that this is inherently inflationary? And does that mean that the debate about whether inflation is transitory or persistent is going to be resolved as a result of this geopolitical escalation? Or how should we think about inflation in this new environment?
There are a whole bunch of different dimensions to consider inflation and lenses through which to think about our mental models. One is through conflict. Another is through, and these are related, through globalization. So I think we've been through, we're on the other side of this, what had seemed like an inexorable trend toward deeply integrating our economies globally. We call that globalization. And I think we're at the other side of that, meaning that for decades, really the entirety of my career, we have seen ever deeper integration of the global economy and different economies with one another. And that is by nature a disinflation or deflationary force, in the sense that whenever there's a shortage of something one part of the world, if politicians, policymakers, companies, state-owned enterprises, if they all feel comfortable more or less in looking for whatever those supplies are that are in shortage in their domestic market, if they're comfortable going abroad to source, you know, more supply, then naturally you can solve a shortage pretty easily. And it may not even be that you're just trying to source the supply right away. You may actually be going to a different country to try to create more supply of whatever that may be. And that could be, by the way, it could be labor, it could be goods, it could be products or services in the case of, you know, a lot of global services enabled by technology, call centers, whatever. And so in an environment where there's great comfort in globalization and there's an expectation that that will continue on, and importantly, where the world is largely speaking in a peaceful environment, then a lot of decisions that are made make the economy more efficient, although you introduce new types of fragilities. And one of the fragilities is that there's some type of shock in some part of that really complex supply chain. One of the fragilities is that in the event of rising conflict, that all of a sudden you look at your supply chains and go, they may not be as robust as we once hoped because there could be a military conflict or something, you know, something like that. And so I think that's, when you think about conflict and you think about inflation, I think that's just a really important thing to consider, because we seem to, number one, very clearly be moving into a direction of deglobalization and kind of the reshoring of certain critical industries and some industries that aren't necessarily critical. And people are worried about their supply chains because of rising conflict. And the consequence of that is that people start trying to look for sources of supply that aren't necessarily as efficient, and they're willing to pay a premium for those things just because they're more stable. And so those are, you know, those are very important things to consider. I think that that's what we're seeing right now for sure. I mean, I think there are other aspects to inflation, but that's a big important one, and one that I don't think is going to turn quickly, meaning I don't think that someone's going to snap their fingers and we're going to enter a more peaceful period ahead. Nor do I think that there's any type of action that's going to lead to deeper integration and globalization right now. I think the trends are very strongly in opposition to that.
Eric, I think this is monumentally important, because so many people are still talking about, look, you know, stop worrying so much about inflation. It's just supply chain disruptions from the pandemic. And as the pandemic's ending, the supply chain is going to get resolved. It's all going to be fine. Inflation's coming back down. Just relax already. And I'm kind of like, wait a minute. You think pandemics screw up supply chains? try global wars. You know, that's a big deal. So it seems to me like everybody is starting to talk now about reshoring of critical industries and so forth. They've got the message that we need to recognize that we're dependent on a lot of international relationships that are breaking down for commerce. But I don't see most people taking the next step, at least as far as what I'm reading. People don't seem to be going to the next step saying, wait a minute, it could be that the supply chain disruptions caused by COVID were just the warm-up, and the supply chain disruptions that are still coming as a result of rising geopolitical conflict could easily be several times worse than what we saw with COVID. Would you agree with that? I don't want to, you know, put words in your mouth. Am I exaggerating when I look at it that way?
I don't have a strong opinion in terms of magnitude, because the supply chain disruptions that we saw coming from COVID were obviously dramatic and in some cases immediate. And I think what we're talking about with rising global conflict is much more of a chronic situation. I think if there were a hot war, like for instance, if the Chinese invaded Taiwan, which I don't expect to be imminent in any way, but let's just hypothetically, if they did do that, then you'd see a dramatic impact on supply chains globally. But you don't need to have a hot conflict to disrupt supply chains. You need to have simply this reversal in this trend toward globalization and an increased awareness and concern over just the overall climate of international relations, which is what we have right now. So, you know, you see things like the U.S. putting in place some type of program to bring supply manufacturing back to the U.S. You know, that causes inflation. You know, where are you going to find those people, and how are you going to build those plants, and where are you going to get that machinery, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that causes inflation. So all sorts of things cause inflation over different time horizons. I think the pandemic was a really dramatic shock and will have a big effect on inflation expectations for a long period of time, because it's really the first time, certainly in the US and Europe in our lifetimes, that we saw such dramatic impacts on inflation. And we also saw the ability of governments to create tons of money in a really short period of time. And that, I think, has loosened the relationship that we have between kind of money and stability. And so that, you know, that has the potential to impact inflation and inflation expectations for a very long time. But anyway, I think that the this period of deglobalization and rising conflict will have effects on inflation over a long period of time. And hopefully we don't have a hot war that's any worse than what we currently have going on in Ukraine, because that, you know, that would obviously cause a sharp spike in inflation, although inflation would probably be the least of our worries at that stage.
Another theme that I've discussed with several other recent guests has been food and energy. We've obviously got an energy crisis in Europe. My contention is that's not really a European energy crisis. It's a global energy crisis that's just getting started and which is being felt the most in Europe right now. When I interviewed Lee Gehring on this program, he told me that, you know, energy is a really big deal, but just wait until the feedback loops around food kick in and we start to get the food supply chain, which is very globalized, start to break down. What are your thoughts on those topics?
I agree. I don't think that this is strictly a European energy crisis. I think it's most acute right now in Europe, certainly in the developed world. I also think, though, that, and this won't affect the global macro markets that we trade immediately, but I think the shortages that we're seeing in energy and in food, and let's remember that the two are really highly correlated. I mean, food that we eat is more or less just energy. You know, like when you look at the inputs that go into food, they're mostly fossil fuel in truth. And so anyway, there's a relationship between food and energy. I think that we have underinvested in the production, certainly of energy, and therefore food, and that the shortages that we're starting to see unfold are going to ripple across the world. What's interesting, and I think quite tragic, honestly, is that well-intended governments in the West and Europe and the U.S. and Japan, even we're seeing, you know, programs to subsidize energy consumption, in some cases food consumption. And it's not that those are bad in and of themselves. It's just that effectively what they do is they push that shortage to the countries that can least afford it. And so I think, you know, over the next couple of years, we should expect to see some real problems throughout the emerging world with people just not having enough to eat. And, you know, I think that will become a big issue in terms of macro markets and geopolitics when those people start moving to the wealthier countries. And so we've seen waves of that happen, Northern Africa and the Middle East, where you see waves of immigration when there's real hardship in their countries. I think, you know, we see that to a degree in the U.S. with the South and Central Americans making their way up to the U.S. at various points in time when conditions are difficult in their countries. I think it's highly likely that we see those types of things unfold over the next few years.
Okay, Eric. So we've talked about food and energy. We've talked about supply chains. I think you and I agree that these are both bigger deals than the market has really absorbed yet. Well, that's very unfortunate for the world because these are horrible things. But as investors, our job is to think about how that variant perception gives us trading edge. So if we know that the supply chain problems are not going away just because the pandemic is going away, because we've got a new source of supply chain challenges, and we've got food and energy challenges that are likely to drive inflation beyond the levels that most people are expecting. How do we translate that to an investment thesis?
Yeah, that's always the trick. And I think we're mentioning, or so far we've talked about some things that that are challenges. You know, that said, humans are pretty good at overcoming challenges, and oftentimes, you know, the great challenges make us better, provided we survive them. So I guess first and foremost, we should hope that we don't have some type of great power hot war. We've seen smaller wars over the last couple decades, but they don't really, I mean, relative to kind of some of the conflicts that are brewing right now, they don't really count. So when we think about the investment framework and the world that we're in right now, and kind of how to think about investing and positioning for this world. You know, while we've talked about challenges in energy supplies and food supplies, and we've talked about deglobalization, we've talked about rising conflict, some of the things that I think will inevitably come out of that are a lot of volatility, because markets never move just in one direction. And there'll be periods where, you know, in the cycle that we see ahead, where there will be expectations of, you know, of less conflict, and that will be a relief to markets. And there'll be periods where, you know, energy prices come off and that might feel, you know, good, or food prices come off, you get a good harvest. And so there'll be volatility in these markets. But I think that to answer the real question about how to position for this, I'll kind of go back to our framework for how to think about the overriding place where we are in market. So I'd say and this is big picture, Eric. So if we look back at the last, you know, few decades, we've been in this period of globalization, which we've talked about. What has globalization done? Well, amongst a number of other trends, what it's done, it's been a force for real moderation in markets. And it's allowed economies to become ever more efficient, also fragile, but ever more efficient. It's allowed the global economy to solve all sorts of shortages and surpluses. So if there's a surplus of, you know, any commodity or any good or labor in a particular region or country, global CEOs figure out a way to maximize the utility of that excess resource or labor, whatever it may be. So when you think about what that leads to, it leads to markets that are more prone to mean reversion, because, you know, prices jump up and, you know, the market figures out how to correct that. It's been amplified by central bank policy, which has really been the dominant policy for the last, you know, few decades. And so whenever there's a recession, central bankers, you know, come in and lower interest rates and do increasingly aggressive rounds of stimulus, which has kind of led to where we are right now, which we've seen massive QE programs and low rates forever. And, you know, we're finally now readjusting from that period. But starting in 2020, that pandemic from our perspective, was the catalyst that has catapulted us into a very new paradigm, market paradigm, this paradigm of deglobalization, rising conflict, politicians becoming much more important features of the market. So if for the last few decades, it was all about central bankers. Well, now, once we required a large fiscal stimulus to get the world out of this, this deep economic crisis sparked by COVID and our response to COVID, what you really did is you reignited politicians as actors in the economy. And so once politicians get engaged, all sorts of kind of wild things can happen because politicians are so different from one another. Just, if you look at even in the US, you look at, Trump versus Biden, very different economies, depending on who's in power. And so what we think we are entering into now, or in what we are already in, is a period because of deglobalization, because of rising conflict, because of the tendency for politicians to stimulate in, a whole range of ways, or impose, who knows, capital controls, or impose different stimuluses for solar energy, or decide to do something militarily. We're going to see all kinds of wider dispersion in outcomes, because like the last 30 years, if central bankers have been the dominant policymakers, well, they all kind of did the same thing across countries. I mean, all the central bankers more or less used the Fed playbook for the last few decades, because in an increasingly globalizing world, if you didn't do what the Fed did, your currency would get really strong. And people couldn't, in a world where everyone valued deeper integration with their economies, and aka globalization, you couldn't have a really strong currency. And so what it did is because the US has the global reserve currency and the Fed more or less is in charge of that, everyone had to adopt the Fed model. So we had very homogeneous policy for the last few decades, and it grew increasingly homogeneous. But now that we have politicians making big fiscal decisions and all sorts of other decisions, including engaging in, in war and hostility of all sorts, we should have much more dispersion. And actually, a world of deglobalization is kind of the opposite of this mean reversion type environment. And it actually is it's an environment of reflexivity, meaning that when you have trends, they will oftentimes reinforce themselves as opposed to self-moderate. So an example of that would be, if you have a shortage of fuel somewhere in the world, well, what do all sorts of countries do? They don't try to figure out how to use their resources to solve that shortage. They start going, holy cow, what if my access to fuel is cut off, and we're going to need, maybe we should be hoarding. Maybe we should be hoarding food, or maybe we should be hoarding energy. Or maybe we need to start building domestic supplies. And by building domestic supplies, it's going to require a hell of a lot more steel or different energy inputs and labor in order to, make the investment in the infrastructure to produce whatever is in short supply. And so those are markets where I think you'll start to see very large trends develop. And reflexive trends mean the price goes up, and that makes the price go up even more. Obviously, the price doesn't go to the sky. So you'll have big trends, and then you'll have big crashes. And so we expect in this kind of new market paradigm to see very large market moves. We've started to see those. Trend following is a great strategy for that. Volatility is a great strategy. Dispersion of all sorts is a great strategy. I think the right way to think about it is the things that worked best in the old paradigm are probably unlikely to be the things that work best. Maybe they work horribly in this new market paradigm. And the things that were kind of unloved in the previous paradigm, probably going to start working a lot better.
Eric, I really think you're onto something with this idea that mean reversion is going to give way to reflexivity. Let's apply that to one specific scenario, which is evolving as we speak. On Tuesday morning of this week, rumors began surfacing saying China is going to come out of lockdown in March of 2023. And then that was promptly denied officially, but a whole bunch of people who are expert on the situation have said, probably there's something afoot here, and whether or not it's exactly going to be March of 23 or not, we don't know, but it's probably coming, and we've probably reached a point where China is unable to continue its COVID zero policy without getting to an outright breakdown in civil unrest in that country. We don't know, as we're only taping this interview on Tuesday afternoon, what's going to happen. So our listeners may know more about how this resolved in the short term. But let's ignore the question of whether this particular rumor is true or not and get to sometime China is going to reopen. If we think of that in the old school of mean reversion, it should be, oh, well, if China's reopening, that means that supply chain issues should get much better because China's going to keep exporting stuff and we'll have more things and the supply chain's just going to get better. Is that the right way to think about it? Or is there a different way in this new era of reflexivity that we should think about what China reopening means?
Yeah, it's a good question, Eric. These are the sorts of questions that are kind of easy to answer in isolation. So all else equal, the answer is yes. If China reopens, supply chains should free up more than they would have been if China were not reopened. But the world's obviously a lot more complex than that. And so China reopening, what does that really mean? Will it mean that Chinese start traveling abroad a ton all of a sudden? Is that what it'll mean? And what will that do to all sorts of consumption patterns and prices and current account deficits or surpluses all over the world? Because they have a pretty big footprint globally. What does it mean for consumption of energy and commodities within China? Do they just go back to what they were doing before? And I think the answer to all those things is we don't really know. And you tell me what will be the state of play between the U.S. and Taiwan when that happens, because that will have an influence on it. I will tell you that a lot of those things are kind of unknown as we sit here now and we talk about what's going to be happening in March. What I think is known is that every CEO in the world, not just in the U.S., but in the world, has woken up to the possibility that having really complex global supply chains are a real risk to their business. It's not that there's no benefit to them. They know what the benefit is. It's just all of a sudden they're waking up to these things being a real risk. And so I think that this is a broad statement, but broadly speaking, all of these CEOs are in the process of making decisions to create greater redundancy in their supply chains. They just are. They have to. They just have to. And by the way, when you look at what happened to the Nord Stream pipelines, that's a wake-up call to every government in the world to relook at their critical infrastructure and imagine how vulnerable it is to attack, terrorism, whatever it may be. And they have to ask themselves, how robust is our critical infrastructure? And if the answer is it's not extremely robust, then they need to start making decisions around that. And then I'm sure that they are. Doesn't mean that that'll all happen overnight. But these are things that I think no matter what the state of play is with China reopening, not reopening, or how we're doing with Taiwan or any of these questions, I think we can know with a high degree of certainty that politicians and CEOs are going to begin restoring greater redundancy to their supply chains and infrastructure. And that's a really big deal because that really has not been happening for the last, the last few decades, which is why you have something like Nord Stream, which you can easily blow up, right? But if we're in a world where no one's really worried about that, then it doesn't matter. You go, let's build a pipeline under, unprotected under a huge ocean, and anyone with a drone could blow the thing up whenever they want. Not a big deal if no one's worried about tension, but in this world, it's a very big deal.
Eric, it seems to me that in finance, we have a whole new challenge that we haven't even begun to take on yet, which is the financial industry is extremely good at looking at companies in very close detail and looking at their balance sheets and saying, okay, what kind of debt do they have? What kind of subordinated debt do they have? What kind of senior debt do they have? How are we going to analyze what this company's shares are actually worth based on these very nuanced analyses of the debt structure of that company? Well, hey, wait a minute. What about other questions like, is it even possible for them to keep making their product if we start not being friendly with company X, where their supply chain is entirely dependent on, you know, some particular product, whether it's semiconductors out of Taiwan or palm oil out of the Philippines or wherever it comes from. I pick your favorite example. It seems to me like we don't have the ability to analyze companies in portfolios and say, what are the supply chain risks that are likely to arise if geopolitical relations worsen with country X, Y, or Z? Is that something that we need to develop a system for?
I'm sure a lot of people who are good at these things will make a lot of money in this environment because most people aren't. I mentioned earlier that I think dispersion is going to be a really important theme going forward. And the flip side to that is that indexing, broadly speaking, I think won't be. And just kind of long-only investing, I think we've most likely seen the peak of that. It's probably behind us at this stage. And so, you know, investors who are creatively minded, who are not just looking at correlations that worked over the last 10 years, but are thinking independently and trying to consider these different risks, I think they'll do extremely well. You know, we look for all sorts of different macro themes and then think about ways to express them in markets. In our vol portfolio, we run a pretty decent sized dispersion book. And so, you know, we're looking for things that are starting to pop up in the world and just say, well, how do we capitalize on those? So an example might be, well, one of the things that we really capitalize on is we thought that the world would experience, this is, you know, really pre-pandemic, we thought the world would experience a much different inflationary paradigm, but certainly post-pandemic we did. And so we built dispersion baskets in our, you know, in our vol book that bet on greater dispersion between companies that would be affected well by inflation and would be, you know, hurt by inflation. And the market hadn't really priced that in. We looked at, say, something like the LDI and issues in UK pensions. And we're like, okay, well, they had all these pensions they had risks in their books that they either didn't understand or were willing to take and just thought would never be realized. And that created all sorts of chaos in UK markets, and it partially spilled over internationally. But we looked at that and said, well, maybe we should look at US companies which have similar types of exposures in their pension plans. And, you know, are there companies in the world or in the US right now that have big pensions that are exposed, and other companies that have decent sized pensions, but maybe they're not as big as the overall company. And so if there's a pension blow up in the US, the companies that are more exposed are going to get hurt a lot worse than the companies that aren't as exposed. And so, you know, how's the market pricing that? And it's probably pretty easy to conclude that the market's probably not really pricing that because no one's really thought about that risk for a long, long time, or maybe never. So, you know, these are kind of ways that around the edges that we're looking at expressing risks like this. I think there'll be all sorts of people that come up with really creative ways to reevaluate the price of certain credits because of the geopolitical situations, and they'll make a lot of money.
Eric, I definitely agree that passive investing is on the way out, if not already out. If you stop and think about it, the whole rationale for passive as a strategy was really layered on top of the efficient markets hypothesis. The idea was everything's already efficiently priced. You know, the risks and so forth are baked into the price because the market knows the risks. Well, I think it's pretty clear in this environment, the market doesn't understand all of the risks because the risks are changing very dynamically and very quickly due to geopolitical escalation and also to a lesser extent, this trend of inflation, which most people seem to be unable to recognize, may be actually secular and not just transitory, which is certainly the view that I hold. But hang on, what's the next step? Because if we go beyond, okay, it's not passive anymore, to say, well, that means it's a trader's market or it's a stock picker's market. I think we just agreed, you and I are not smart enough to understand all of these risks, of all the things that could go wrong if one particular country stops exporting this. What does it mean to the supply chain for X, Y, and Z? It's such a complicated problem. You can't possibly be smart enough to know all the answers. So if it's not passive and it's not stock picking in the sense of really knowing all the stocks to pick, What is it? Is it trend following at that point, or what kind of strategy should we employ?
I think you need to employ people who understand their markets extremely well and are flexible in their thinking. So it's of course true that you and I, or you know, there's no one out there who's going to know everything and have all the answers. But I just gave some examples in dispersion in the volatility markets, which is something that we trade a lot of and are expert in, and we've been able to find really good opportunities in those through our macro lens, and then in our expertise in dispersion trading. And I think there'll be all sorts of, and you look at a lot of the macro managers this year, and most of them have had very good years. So, and this is a good environment for that. I sincerely doubt that we're going to have, a good year or a couple good years, and then these major macro forces of the last 30 years are just suddenly restored to balance, and we go back to levered carry passive investing, at very low levels of inflation and accommodative monetary policy, and everything's back to normal. And it was just a 2 or 3 year blip. I don't think that's the case at all. And so I think it's important to find investors who understand their markets really well and can, take proactive risks. I think one of the ways to capitalize on this, it's been very successful this year. We run some of these strategies or trend following strategies and trend. And incidentally, we have held the view for a couple of years that in this new market paradigm, because it's this transition from mean reversion pre-pandemic to reflexivity post-pandemic, and that this is going to be probably a 10-ish year period. And I say 10 years, not because it's a specific time, it's just like a good chunk of time. You see these decade long periods like the 1970s where we had very large market moves, for instance. And so I think one way of capitalizing on change is to invest in trend following. Because if you think of what is a price trend is a movement in price that reflects a future state of the world that's really quite different from today. And in a world where things are more reflexive, there is going to be big change. And so you can capitalize on that by investing in very smart people who know their markets well, who can identify with high conviction changes in the markets where they're expert in, and then make appropriately risk-managed bets in those spaces, and those people will do well. The advantage of trend following is that you get wide breadth. So, across our two strategies, we cover about 160 different markets. And if you can make similarly sized bets in all those markets and follow those trends, you might be wrong intuitively about the direction of the change, and you're still going to make money in that strategy, which is great, because in a world where an awful lot of things are changing, pretty substantially, you might be right about some of them, but you're not going to be right about all of them. And the good thing about a systematic trend following strategy is that it's dispassionately just following those trends and capitalizing on those moves. And you don't have had to have done the analysis. You just have to have the insight that we're actually going to see some big moves here. And then that strategy capitalizes on it. So that's how we look at that.
Eric, let's come back to this question of transitory or secular inflation. I'd like to take it a step farther because, first of all, I'm convinced it's not transitory. I think inflation is here to stay. I'm going to suggest that maybe it's not just here to stay, but maybe it's intentional, because the way I've seen this is governments really have no choice but to inflate away their debt. Is that what's happening? Are we seeing the beginning of a new regime of financial repression that's going to last for decades the way it did after World War II?
Yeah, I think that's a very important thing to keep in the back of your mind throughout this, that what's happening right now, I believe strongly, is deliberate policy. So, we've spent these last 30 years with central banks, in essence, bailing out the economy in each recession. And at first, it was just through rates, and then increasingly it became through QE and then bailouts of all sorts. And we've finally gotten to really the natural conclusion of that journey, which is that you have very large government debts. And so when people look around and they say, well, the consumer seems okay and the banking system seems okay, it's like, well, they do seem okay because they've really been bailed out by the government. And not because anyone's a bad person or that they were making what they thought was stupid policy. They just kept trying to create sustained economic growth, and it required increasing doses of intervention to do that. And so the natural destination for that journey is a place where actually the fragility lies in the government balance sheet, and they've taken on all sorts of debt. And not only that, but they have made enormous entitlement promises to the baby boomers. And so I think, you know, when you, we've talked about global supply chains and deglobalization and rising conflict, et cetera. And we've looked at those things and we've said, well, you know, those are drivers of inflation. There are other drivers of inflation too. The really big one is that there's a deliberate government policy to try to unburden the sovereign balance sheet of all these debts by creating inflation. And the way you do that, well, you do it in all sorts of ways. We've seen what they've accomplished recently, which is not to say that they're thrilled about the pace of inflation relative to actual growth. I mean, we've had a huge nominal increase in GDP so far this year with really anemic growth, you know. But when you think about what that does is it increases nominal GDP and it makes the debt to GDP go down even though we're running deficits. So the way that governments ultimately do that is the way that they unburden themselves from these debt levels through financial repression is that they keep nominal GDP as high as they possibly can. And that's through some combination of hopefully decent growth, but potential growth in the U.S. is probably not more than 1 or 2%. I mean, it really isn't. It could be, let's call it between 0 and 2%. And so they're going to have a nice hefty rate of inflation over time on top of that. And then you have to keep interest rates much below those levels. And so right now, that's what you see. I know people talk about real rates being positive way out the curve. But if you look in the front end of the curve, you know, we have overnight rates reasonably low relative to inflation, which is pretty darn high, which is, you know, over 8%. So I think we see a long period of policy like this. And so naturally, the headlines will read, well, the Fed is unhappy with inflation at these levels. And I know that they are unhappy with it. They don't want to see this run away. They don't want to see a hyperinflation. And so they'll try to rein it back in. But I think what we should expect to see is, you know, on average, quite high levels of inflation relative to what we've experienced for the last decade. So we could see inflation bumping around between 2 and 7% or 2 and 8% for the next few years. And maybe it averages out at 4, 5, or 6%. It's a much, much different inflation dynamic. And it will all have been deliberate through that time.
Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit more about what you do at One River Asset Management. And particularly, something new since I've known you is now One River Digital. What's the angle there?
Sure. So we're at our core a macro firm. We're very opportunistic. We express all sorts of views either systematically or through our discretionary strategies. We're about a $3 billion firm. We run risk and volatility strategies. So we have a discretionary long volatility strategy. We have a systematic long equity volatility strategy. We have a high sharp volatility RV, so market neutral strategy, which is where we express risk in things like dispersion. We have a couple of trend following strategies, so systematic trend following strategies for core markets and for more esoteric markets. We run an inflation strategy. So these are all kind of core macro type strategies that we run. We combine some of those for our clients in ways that have really helped them. So we have a risk responder strategy that combines our long volatility with trend and in a very capital and fee efficient way. And that's a great diversifier for our large institutional clients. But we also entered the digital asset arena in November of 2020 with what at the time was the largest Bitcoin and Ethereum trade for institution. We made an awful lot of money out of that and returned all that capital. And we used that whole opportunity and entrance into that market to build out a digital asset manager. And it's been really interesting and fun. I think digital assets and blockchain technology will be foundational to the future of finance. And our job is to be looking for the emerging risks and opportunities in the marketplace. And we see both digital assets and digital asset infrastructure as being really important opportunities. And we wanted to make sure that that we really participated in that. So it's been a really interesting part of my career so far, and it's only been a couple years into it. We brought some great, you know, some great partners into that as well. And so that's what our business looks like.
Eric, on the digital side, I really want to give you credit because, frankly, the fact that you guys made a shitload of money on Bitcoin doesn't impress me much because a whole bunch of people made a shitload of money on Bitcoin because it was just trending at the time. What you have not done is to subsequently lose a shitload of your clients' money on Bitcoin. Please explain how you managed to avoid that because it's a mistake that most people were not able to avoid.
You know, you never want to jinx yourself in markets. We're fortunate to work with a great investor on our early Bitcoin Ethereum trades, and they brought enormous insights to the table and timing, quite frankly. But we did make very large investments in March of 2020, and exited over the subsequent 9 months or so into that large rally, and generated, you know, really quite enormous gains. And then return capital. And so, you know, the market was extremely euphoric. And I think, you know, when you think about market cadence, there are times where markets are in euphoric period and there are times where they're in a really depressed period. That was, it was very clearly a period of real euphoria. And I'm just kind of grateful that we crystallized those gains and returned them. I think since then, you know, all the market's really crashed, and it's not to say that we haven't had any exposure to that. We have had some exposure, although it's a small fraction of what we had, you know, in that run up. And we've been, you know, fortunate. We never got involved in any of these high yields in DeFi, and so we didn't, and our investors didn't suffer any of the losses there. We didn't get involved in Luna. We thought that there were some weaknesses in that whole system. And managed to avoid that. So we've been thankful that I think we've taken a pretty sensible macro view to digital assets. As I mentioned, I think that these will be the foundation of the future of finance, but they're going to be a lot of pitfalls along the way. And so this big market decline has been one of them. I'm grateful, you know, touch wood, that we didn't suffer any type of catastrophic losses, and we dodged all the big bullets there, which is not to say we won't ever get clipped at some point in the future. But I'm, you know, very proud of the team. We've built an amazing team that has brought great insights to this. And now I think we're really well positioned for the next upcycle. I think we'll have a very big upcycle, by the way. We're seeing increased use cases for these technologies. I think they're becoming widely accepted. We're seeing regulatory competition between nations to see who can be the leader in the digital asset space. I think it's very smart for nations because this is going to be a source of great innovation. And ultimately, these technologies will form the foundation for new infrastructure for the, you know, the global financial system. And so, as I said, we're going to be part of that. And I'm just grateful that we've kind of made it through this market crash, you know, pretty well intact.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac-certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, Great interview with Eric Peters. Now joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, Eric, I always love to get Eric Peters back on the show, and I thought your conversation with him on the future of passive investing was particularly relevant to the coming decade's macro backdrop. Now, what did you take away?
Well, Patrick, what I've been thinking about since this interview and after reading a few other things that have come out this week is just this overall market reaction that people are having, saying, oh boy, reshoring is going to be the trend. Yeah, that's it. Well, okay, wait a minute. I think that's right. We are going to need to reshore a lot of critical industries that have been globalized in recent years. But let's remember how we got here. The whole globalization trend was entirely about exploiting cheap overseas labor. So if we're going to reshore these critical industries, first of all, we don't have the talent to do that anymore. The people who had those skills, we lost those jobs in this country and in Canada several decades ago. We haven't been sending to people to vocational schools to learn to be machinists and welders and so forth, because a lot of those industries were moved overseas. If we're going to move them back, it's not a matter of just flipping a switch. And when we do, the labor cost is going to be dramatically higher. That has to be extremely inflationary. So all this talk about inflation is transitory and it's peaking and it's going away, it just doesn't make sense when you consider the big picture of what's going on. If we're going to reshore critical industries that were offshored for the sake of exploiting cheap labor, then the price is going to go up and the price of everything is going to go up. And furthermore, we can't just turn it on like a switch. It's going to take a lot of time and energy, and there's going to be a lot of cost and a lot of product shortages. So I think it's definitely time to get ready for shortages of just about everything in coming years.
Okay, so let's get to the post-game chart deck. Now, listeners, you'll find the download link to the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Eric Peters' picture that says looking for the downloads. Now, joining us here is Nick. Now, Nick, what a crazy reaction to that FOMC.
Yeah, that was something to see post-FOMC. That website was quite a move. I have some levels that I'm watching right now. But first, Eric, perhaps we can get your point of view on this.
I thought the market reaction to Wednesday's FOMC statement and the subsequent about-face after Jay Powell said, well, sorry, we only meant what we actually said, not what the market tried to read into it, I thought it was very telling. This week's events just further cement a view in my mind that the market is completely fixated on expectations of a Fed pivot, which lack any basis in reality. The Fed has been clear that they hope to slow down the pace of rate hikes when conditions warrant. That means when inflation comes under control. So if you share my view that inflation will be persistent, there's just no good reason to be anticipating a dovish Fed pivot or even a Fed pause. But that still seems to be what markets are obsessed with, even in the wake of this week's events. Bottom line, if I have the inflation thing all wrong, then yeah, sure, the Fed will pivot and markets will scream higher just as soon as inflation comes under control. But if I'm right about inflation remaining persistent, there's just no sane reason for all this pivot expectation mania. And at some point, the market is going to price that reality in and we're going to see a big move down. And it won't be pretty when that happens. Now, obviously, that's strongly at odds with everything that I said last week about my expectation that maybe the rally that we were starting to see was going to flourish and continue all the way through year end. Well, the facts change. I changed my opinion. In this case, I think that the market has finally woken up this week to the Fed telling them again that there's no reason to be expecting a pivot. Now, if we get back into everybody expecting a pivot, there is room for this to turn around and for the rally to continue through the year end for all of the reasons that I described last week. But I think this may have been a big enough wake-up call to change that direction. It'll be very interesting to see what the next few days reveal. And certainly, if we get to new lows below 3,500, I think it's a pretty strong sign that we're headed considerably lower than that.
Yeah, it's amazing, Eric, how has completely changed just through one FOMC meeting. Anyway, Nick, you were saying you were watching some of these levels. What's your thinking here?
Well, looking at the longer term timeframes, we're seeing significant support, obviously, at 3,500 roughly on SPX. and resistance high at 3,900 roughly. I'm looking at the November 9th OPEX. The reason being, obviously, is that that encapsulates the November 8th midterm elections. And current spot, as I speak, is 3,740. The straddle cost right now is about 110 on SPX, which denotes about a 3% move by November 9th. So the upper expected move is around 3,850, which we hit yesterday, obviously. And the lower expected move is around 3,630, which is just above the support of 3,600 and the very strong support of 3,500. Now, obviously, these levels could be tested in the same week at the high and the low based on what happens. But I think that the Fed obviously doesn't want markets to rise, hence why we had the discussion yesterday on further rate increases, because obviously markets rising is inflationary. And you really need to be a market historian with a malleable mentality to succeed in the markets, studying the past, but also ascertaining the differences in current macro climates. And so analyzing the past, we can look at what happened prior to the midterm elections, as well as what happened after those elections. And so seeing that since 1946, in the last 19 midterm elections, 17 of those events resulted in higher market performance in the 6 months following the election. It's pretty interesting, because analyzing why that occurred typically was because we saw higher spending as a result of regime change, perhaps. And that may not be the case in this high inflationary environment. But what are your thoughts here, Patrick?
Well, you know what? That S&P 500 went right up to that 3,900 to 4,000 target zone. That's where our Fibonacci zones were, and a typical market reaction from a very oversold condition would typically retrace to those types of zones. And I was really a bit surprised by the hawkishness of the FOMC, not because it wasn't a possibility, but rather I didn't think they were going to do it before the elections. I thought this kind of a hawkish statement could be far more likely in December. And if they came far more in line, that's where there would have been room for the S&P to try to take a stab over 4,000. But clearly, this tone that Powell took has really shaken the markets. And the rejection here just above 3,900 rollover is a red flag. Now, while the S&P has not yet broken below 3,700, a level which I'm watching very closely, the issue is the NASDAQ has totally broken down. And while we have not seen the NASDAQ break to a lower low yet, the fact that the FANG stocks are screaming lower, many gaps to the downside, the big leadership and generals in that market are getting hammered. And so you take the wind out of the sails of sectors like the financials and other things that were really counting on the Fed kind of easing here a little bit. We could, and the market can be quite vulnerable here. Now, while you're absolutely right that 3,500 is a level to watch, especially since it was where the previous lows were along in October, but this pattern of lower highs and lower lows and bear market price action has not been violated. And if this rejection in any way leads to an S&P breaking below 3,700, while 3,500 will be the first target zone, we might finally see that sell-off that heads all the way down to 3,200 to 3,400. I'll say while I'm making that forecast, it's not what I originally thought was going to play out. And the fact that this is happening pre-elections makes me kind of scratch my head as to is this really a scenario that's going to happen here in the week to come? Maybe the market settles in here for the jobs numbers and the elections, and then the move happens post-election. But right now, it's a market that has failed at key levels and remains rather weak.
There's a saying I've been hearing, Patrick, and it's that the generals are the last to be shot. And looking at the FANG man names, we're seeing a lot of them collapse down below support levels we haven't seen in many years. And there's still a lot of downside in certain names, like Google, for example. You look at the price it was trading at in 2020, and it's still far off that level right now. Meta's, you know, fallen drastically in the last week or so, from, you know, $137 down to $90 as we speak or so. And Amazon has broken key support levels too. So if Apple and Microsoft keep breaking down, the market could easily fall, you know, I would say probably 10% more or so from here. That's just my point of view.
Yeah. Well, you know what's also interesting, Nick? I actually expected on such a clear reversal in the markets that there would be a bigger reaction to the VIX. On page 3, I have the volatility index chart, and it didn't seem to at least initially react with any big spike. I mean, we're sitting at 26, which is still an elevated level of volatility. But for me, I think the market shows signs of true nervousness when we're north of 30, and we're still not there. What do you taking away from the VIX?
Well, looking at the VIX right now, on the 3-month time frame hourly chart, I'm seeing that we're near support at around 25-ish. And if we turn back up toward 30, that's where things can get really ugly, because obviously yesterday, initially post the 2 p.m. minutes, we saw the market kind of stagnate, then rise gradually, which caused the VIX to plummet. And then we sold off after Powell's comments, and that caused the VIX to also decline gradually as well, which is very intriguing. So right now, given the current level 26, we expect about 1.7, 1.8% moves each day in broad markets. But it'll be curious to see if we break above 30 again in the short term, because we haven't seen a lot of those crazy 2, 3, 4% down days that we saw back in 2020. And if those start coming our way, we could see the VIX spike to 35 and above in short order. Obviously, the elections will play a lot into that next week, depending on what happens. Now, Eric, on page 4, we have the dollar index. What are your thoughts over here?
We've moved from a global economy threatening uptrend on the Dixie to a sideways consolidation. But there's no reason to conclude that a trend reversal has occurred, at least not yet. The chart is an easy read, with the consolidation neatly confined between 110 and 114 on the Dixie. Until we see a sustained move outside that range, we're consolidating sideways. End of story, and there's no reason to conclude that the trend has reversed.
Yeah, Eric, I'll have to say that the Dixie and the dollar index reaction to that hawkish Fed really actually, I think, is a true advertisement of what's in store for the broader intermarkets. One of the whole themes I had was that, well, if we had a short to intermediate swing high in the dollar, maybe the dollar put in a high for the year, not necessarily the end of the major trend, but simply just a pause, then that would have allowed all risk assets to be able to take a breath and continue a year-end rally of some sort. But the hawkishness of the Fed has really sent that dollar index screaming higher, and we're above what I was watching, a key level around 112. I mean, at this stage, obviously, all those major highs are near 114. But boy, is it really just want to look like that dominant U.S. dollar trend remains intact. At this moment, every dip gets bought. The dollar index goes screaming higher. But in this case, almost every cross currency against that U.S. dollar is getting hammered. The euro is down towards 97 cents. The pound sterling rolling over again. But the one that I'm watching on page 5 is what's going on in that U.S. dollar yen, because we had two direct interventions by the Bank of Japan to try to stabilize the currency. And while it paused the U.S. dollar advance, it really certainly has not reversed the trend. And if right now this the hawkishness Fed and higher interest rates in the U.S. Is now being priced in, what if this sends that U.S. dollar yen to a fresh new high? I mean, then we could see 155, 158. And I think that there's a lot of macro traders that have been trying to already be playing the story that the U.S. dollar yen is at least the yen is super cheap. And yet we see this in a Canadian dollar rolling, Australian dollar rolling over. Everything is just getting hammered here. And if that U.S. dollar strength persists, it's really going to be a drag on risk assets.
Yeah, Patrick, I definitely agree with that assessment. I was looking at the Bank of Canada last week raising their rates by 50 pips and thinking that if the Fed raised by 75, that it would be insufficient in keeping their dollar at current levels. And I guess I was correct in that assessment. But on slide 6 over here, we have crude oil. Now, Patrick, what are you seeing here?
Well, you know what, Eric, you were talking about that 200-day moving average, and I just thought it would be relevant to show it on the chart here. And it really is depicting a very important line in the sand in terms of the bull and bear trend. What's interesting is that in a lot of risk assets turned decisively on the Fed, and oil paused, but it hasn't broken in any way. I'll agree with your assessment. And, you know, a clearing of 90 is incredibly important, even if that moving average wasn't there. The reality is that since June, we've been in a sequence of lower highs and lower lows and predominant weakness in distribution. But what we've seen really in the month of October is an SPR release, an attempt to talk oil prices down, and yet oil has crawled higher and not making lower lows. And really, to decisively change the trend, to really get trend followers to start piling into the oil trade, that break of 90 will be a true advertisement that oil has begun some sort of a new bull leg. So watching that into next week is something that's certainly on my mind. I wanted to move on here to page 7, and I'm looking here at this gold chart, and I'll stand by my view here, which is that while a lot of people are looking at, you know, real rates and other variables, to me, gold has really just been acting like a cross currency to that U.S. dollar, and with that U.S. dollar ripping higher at this juncture, it just dragged gold down. But what we have seen consistently since the downtrend started in March is that sequence of lower highs and lower lows in a very distinctly downwards channel. And as we approach all of these previous lows, gold here is quite vulnerable to still having one more leg down. And while I think the majority of the gold sell-off may be rearview mirror, it doesn't mean that a new uptrend or even a bottoming formation has even begun. If the breakout in the Dixie really does continue, the vulnerability of gold breaking to 1550 to 1600 is the most immediate path of least resistance. At some point, there's going to be a great buy on dip here, but boy, the price action just still looks incredibly weak.
Yeah, Patrick, I definitely agree with your assessment on gold. If it breaks down below 1600, we could see some more downside, but I want your opinion on uranium over here on page 8.
Yeah, obviously we're tracking here with that uranium trust. One commodity that has generally been behaving quite bullishly since bottoming back in the summer has been uranium. It's really shifted to the sequence of making higher highs and higher lows. We, after having this test of the $18 level on this trust unit, are in the midst of a pause and a consolidation. One thing that I'm completely focused on here is whether the pattern of dips being bought persists, which is, let's say we have a quick dip down towards 16.5, which is a very typical retracement. It'll be really interesting to see how quickly the buy on dip traders take advantage of that. A typical behavior that we would see is very similar to what we saw in late September and early October, which is once the price gets hammered for 1 or 2 days, almost immediately the buy on dip traders have a catalyst to immediately start buying and turning it. And it'll be really interesting to see if that emerges after this consolidation.
Yeah, you know, Patrick, we can't really wrap up without touching on the 10-year government yields after that FOMC and that sharp rise we had yesterday. Now, what are your thoughts here?
Well, look, I think everyone was already starting to entertain the idea that there was going to be a dovish tilt and that there was going to be an advertisement that the rate hike cycle may be coming to an end. And when the hawkish tone really came out, everyone's starting to realize that more interest rate hikes are coming, and the bond market just immediately took it very poorly. Now, with yields staying decisively above 4% on the 10-year yields, it really continues to demonstrate the weak state of the bond markets. So they're all of stone's throw from fresh new lows. Yield curves continue to stay inverted in many places. And it's just a condition that is incredibly weak. And if we see the yields break to higher highs in this sequence in any way, that just is going to be compiled with the dollar strength and it's just going to drive further risk off. I'm a little surprised that this is happening right before the elections, but this is just simply it continues to be a scenario where the prevailing trends that have been dominant throughout the year are still the trends that are intact, and it's going to certainly feel like a lot more of this continuation moving forward.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find in the Research Roundup a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book, which is discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to the articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from you, our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this show even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases, and follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thank you for listening, and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.